and welcome to the Common Geeking Program, a book club podcast where each week, three of us read up on a topic and then discuss it from our own geeky and nerdy perspectives. This week, I am your host. My name is Jeff, and we will be discussing the movie Big Fish, specifically focusing on unreliable narrators. And I am joined by two people, each of whom has selected a domain that they think connects to our topic and theme this week. And they are...
Hey, it's me, Keenan, returning once again. I will be talking about the 1950 film Rashomon by Akira Kurosawa.
Fun stuff.
My name is Matt Canavan, and I'm talking about Forrest Gump.
Good shit. Matt is still filling in for our erstwhile Austin. He is leaving the podcast.
Good.
To a degree, which I don't know how much we've officially discussed yet, but you know what? I'm going to leave it as ominous as that. Maybe Thanos killed him. Maybe he's going to grad school. Who knows?
Good riddance.
So Matt's just going to be here for this one cycle temporarily.
Mr. Levitt, I don't feel so good.
Anyway, we're going to start by summarizing our topic and domains before we openly discuss. Finally, we will close with a competitive rating section to determine who contributed the best to this episode of the podcast and whether these guys liked the topic that I brought today.
Spoiler alert, we both make the top two.
Oh, snap.
Because everyone's a winner.
I wish I could subvert that, but he's totally right.
I was aiming for bronze, but all right.
All right. Well, with that said, I think we should move forward. Doodly, doodly do. All right, guys, let's get started. This is going to be the summary section. As I said, we are talking about the movie Big Fish, which I fucking straight up thought right before I got on the call, I should open up a Wikipedia article for that so I know what year it came out. And I just didn't.
2003,
and it was directed by Tim Burton. That part I knew.
I could be wrong. It might not be 2003.
Fuck, you just made that up? I was thinking that didn't sound right. Oh, shit, you were right. It is 2003. Okay, yeah. So this movie came out in 2003. It is directed by Tim Burton. It's not stop motion. It's live action.
It has color in it, which is weird.
Yeah. It's starring Ewan McGregor, Albert Finney, and some other people who matter less. And they play the same character.
Helena Bonham Carter.
Oh, yeah. Helena Bonham. Yeah, well, you know, Tim Burton movie.
Yeah, true.
You're right.
Full disclaimer, I straight up realized half an hour ago that I didn't rewatch this film for this episode of the podcast. I have seen it multiple times. I might need some help filling in gaps because I started watching it half an hour ago and got through only the first quarter of the movie.
I got you.
So are you saying that we have the high ground?
That's what you're saying.
I guess.
Okay.
Sure.
The moral high ground at the very least.
I don't know about that one. But so the general premise of the movie is there's a son and his father. The father is played by Albert Finney, and the son is not played by Ewan McGregor. He's played by some other actor. I can't remember his name. So they have not talked to each other in years because the son has gotten into multiple arguments with his father about how all the stories that he's been telling him his entire life are generally made up and fake. Which we'll talk about that later. Then the father, you know, he's at some point he was diagnosed with cancer and it's getting worse. So the son and his fiance or wife at that point, I'm not sure, go home to visit his parents. And he's trying to make amends with his father and get the real accounts of what happened. So a lot of the movie takes place in the past, in the father's young life, where he is played by Ewan McGregor as a young, charming lad.
So charming.
And we sort of get this, like, fantastical tale of how his life unfolds. So they're actually, in the beginning of the movie, it's starting to be narrated by the son. And he's talking about how, like, you know, he has this account of his father's life, but he knows that most of it is fake and that the parts that did happen were exaggerated.
In telling the story of my father's life, it's impossible to separate fact from the fiction, the man from the myth. The best I can do is to tell it the way he told me.
You know, we see an argument with them early on where it's at, he is married because it's at the son's wedding.
Yeah.
And Albert Finney is telling the story. Oh, his name is Edward Bloom, by the way. I'm going to use his real name, not the actor's name. Well, fake name. The character's name is Edward Bloom. You know what I
mean?
We
understand.
Yeah.
Fake news.
And Edward Bloom is telling the story at his son's wedding, William, about how he was trying to catch this huge fish on the day that his son was born, and he offered it up his wedding ring, and then it's like this whole thing about how, like, you know, you gotta catch a beautiful woman with a wedding ring. And Edward Bloom is compared to a large fish a lot throughout the movie. But that culminates in, like, the son leaves frustrated because he's heard this story a million times and he doesn't want his father, like, stealing his big day. And then they're getting into this argument. And the first thing that we're brought up that Edward Bloom might not be an entirely reliable narrator is William says that story, which evidently didn't happen because you were in Wichita selling novelty items the day I was born. So already we're led to believe that Edward Bloom is not an entirely reliable narrator. Throughout the rest of the story with Ewan McGregor, we get a lot of, like, sort of fantastical things that don't seem quite in the same level of realism as the rest of the film takes place in the present. The first story that we see told is the story of him going as a young child. Him and some other kids go to find this witch's house that lives out in the swamps outside their hometown. And the witch is played by what's her name? Helena
Bonham Carter.
Carter, whatever, however you pronounce her name.
Helly Bomb Bomb Carr.
Yeah, Helly Bomb Bomb Carr, yeah. Which is interesting because we see a couple other characters played by her later. Well, one other character, really. And I'll talk about that in a bit. But this story is, like, she supposedly has this glass eye that when you look into it, you see the way that you die. We see that he does see the way that he dies. And then as an old man, he's talking about, like, oh, everyone doesn't need to be worried so much about this cancer shit. This is not the way that I go, right? And he's sort of leaving it ambiguous as to how he actually dies.
Like a good storyteller.
Yeah, like a good storyteller. Because he sees himself as a storyteller, which is kind of how he justifies all the tall tales that he tells people. He's, like, telling people all of the, you know, the flavor of the story. You get the point. You get, you know, the lessons learned out of it, even if all of the facts aren't exactly as they happened.
Most men, they'll tell you a story straight through. It won't be complicated, but it won't be interesting either.
I think we should note...
Yeah?
I was just going to say, I think we should know that one of the major conflicts with the son is that the son doesn't feel like he knows his father because all he has are these stories that he doesn't believe. Like, for example, that the father was trapped behind enemy lines during... which war was it?
I think it was Vietnam.
I guess it must have been Nam, right? Because
it was Nam.
Or Korea.
Because of the twins, right?
Yeah, and he got trapped behind enemy lines, and the way he got back was he was smuggled out by a conjoined pair of twins.
Like Siamese twins. They have one pair of legs.
And then he helped them get back to Hollywood because he was friends with this circus guy played by Danny DeVito, who, by the way, is a werewolf.
I forgot about Danny DeVito being a werewolf.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, just a little slice of this man's fantastical life and one of the many reasons why his son doesn't believe in the stories.
Yeah, like one of the early things starting out is that, you know, he lives in the town of Ashton, and he starts growing rapidly, and he's explaining... So this is all told through... a flashback of Ewan McGregor telling this story to a young William. And he says that, like, oh, you know, he realized that he started growing so fast that it must be because he was like a goldfish, which grows faster when it's in a larger space. So it must mean that he was meant for greater things. And then there's this conflict in the town where there's this giant named Carl who's eating all the livestock. And, Edward Bloom goes and confronts him, and they end up deciding to leave the town together and go on to bigger things.
Friendship.
And this is how he ends up meeting Danny DeVito's character, because when they go to the circus together, they've got Carl, who's this giant, and Danny DeVito is like, oh, hey, you'd be great in my act. You want to sign your life away real quick?
Well, it was so he could, you know, so he could get information on the pretty girl he saw once, because he knew that... That was his true love.
Yeah, so at the circus, Edward sees the love of his life, who we know to be the same character who is the mother later in the movie.
They say when you meet the love of your life, time stops. And that's true.
And he works out this deal with Danny DeVito that he'll work for him unpaid. And like every month that he works for him, Danny DeVito will give him one piece of information about this girl that he's looking for. And then Carl, you know, stays with him.
After he goes to the circus, he eventually goes to the college where the mother lives, but she's engaged.
She's engaged to a guy that he knew when he was in Ashton, too.
Yeah, and he was always one-upping.
Yeah, we see, like, a montage in the beginning of the movie, and, like, we're supposed to be led to believe that this character is kind of a jerk, but all we see in, like, the beginning of the movie is, like, Edward Bloom doing a bunch of things really well and the other guy being sort of jealous about it. But in some cases, it's like, you know, he like stomps his head into the dirt, right, when he's playing football better than him. And it's just like, okay, well, I can see why this guy might actually not like Edward Bloom very much.
Granted.
No, but like that's part of the interesting part of it, right, is that Ewan McGregor plays a very different character than Albert Finney does. You know, it's not like they play the same character at two different ages. He very much is more of a fantastical, like idealized figure than Albert Finney's Edward Bloom is. It's sort of representative of like, oh, the stories that your father tells you about himself when he was young. A young child might see him, his father as like this idealized figure and not really take into consideration like his faults or stuff like that, right?
Like, oh, my dad's an asshole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like Edward Bloom is a human. He's not perfect, but...
Yeah. I still think they were very much the same character. But after that happens, he gets in a fight with the fiancé. The fiancé then beats him up, but then our girl is like, oh, well, you know, you're a jerk, and I see that now, and then goes off to marry him.
Yeah.
Soon after, he goes to the Korean War. He's stuck behind enemy lines, gets out. Then he starts becoming a traveling salesman.
Yep.
And who actually, he helped Steve Buscemi, who he met years ago in a small little town.
Oh, yeah. So that town's important because he meets a little girl there, like right when he leaves Ashton. Her name is Jenny. And, you know, when she's a little girl, she's like 8 and he's 18. And then years later, when he's a traveling salesman, he makes his way back to Ashton or back to
Spectre.
Spectre, right, yeah. And then when she's older, she's now played by, you know, Hella Bomb Bomb Cart, whatever the fuck we're calling.
Yeah, but the thing is, the town is, you know, falling on hard times, so he actually starts going around to all the friends he's made, like the guy he helped rob a bank. He actually told him about how the real money is in Wall Street, so he went to Wall Street and now he's a millionaire.
Well, that's also Steve Buscemi's character.
Yeah, that's what
Yeah.
He goes to talk to Danny DeVito. He finds all these people who he's made rich and says, hey, you know, if you buy up stock in this town, I think it will be really good and we can, like, make it a great town again. And so, in a way, according to him, he revitalizes the town, and it, according to,
Jenny,
it turns out that he kind of did, you know, revitalize the town because he finds her. And yeah, he at first thinks that, like, the son thinks that this was his dad's mistress, but really it was just like his friend.
Yeah, but actually it is kind of, I think that's an interesting point to touch on. So later, you know, in the film, the son's going around and trying to, like, make ends meet of this story that his father told him, right? And he goes and he visits Jenny's character, who is now older, right, as you know, Hella Bomb Bomb Cart or whatever. She's definitely is like, she had a thing for him. The son is already assuming that they got together, and then she tells the story and it kind of seems like Edward Bloom said, like, no, listen, I'm, you know, I've got a wife. But part of the interesting part with that then, right, is that she's telling the story and she's like,
as for the girl, the common belief is that she'd become a witch, and crazy at that. She became something of a legend herself. And the story ended where it began.
And of course, she's played by the same actor who played the witch. And the son points out,
well, logically, you couldn't be the witch because she was old when he was young.
And then she says the line, which I think is, like, really telling about the way that Edward Bloom is telling these stories. She says, well,
it's logical if you think like your father. See, to him, there's only two women. Your mother and everyone else.
And I thought that was, like, a really, it's a really cute line. Basically, like, a lot of the movie has been, you know, built up. He keeps saying, like, oh, there's going to be some fantastical way that I go when I die, because I saw it in the witch's eye, right? What ultimately ends up happening is he's brought into the hospital, and the son goes and talks to him, right? And he's like, tell me how I die, right? And he's like, Dad, you never told me the ending of that story. And he's saying, like, no, tell me it anyway, right? So then the son, after this point, you know, learning that perhaps his father is, like, not as unreliable as we were led to believe throughout the entire film, you know, tells him this fantastical story about how he picks him up and he brings him out to the river, and everyone he's ever known is, like, sitting there ready to let him go, right? And then he puts him in the water, and he turns into a giant carp, and he swims away, and he becomes a big fish.
A big fish.
Big fish.
Big fish.
And then with that, Albert Finney is saying, like, yep, that's exactly how it happened, which personally I took to interpret as what he saw in the eye was his son telling him this story. Because, like, earlier in the movie, he makes a mention of how, like, the way that he goes is a lot more unbelievable, right? And we're led to believe that it's, like, all fantastical, like all of his other stories, but really it's like, oh, the unbelievable thing is that he's made amends with his son by this point.
Yeah, I got very much that. It was just that his son Will finally
accepted him.
He passed off the love of stories to his son.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, real quickly, to end this off, I just want to mention, after that, we see the funeral, and we start to see all of these characters that we've heard about showing up at the funeral and seeing glimpses of the reality of the situation, like Carl the Giant, right, who, when we saw him in Edward's story, was, like, twice as tall as he was. He must have been, like, 12 or 13 feet tall, and we see him get out of the car with Danny DeVito, and he's, like, 7 feet tall. So he is a huge guy, but he's not like this giant that he was made out to be.
They also had him standing next to Danny DeVito, and that's going to make anyone look tall.
That's true. No, but he was a big was guy because we did see him in crowds. You know, he was like easily 3 feet taller than everyone else.
Yeah.
Just not double their size. And then we also see, right, Keenan mentioned the twins, mm-hmm. who are not in fact Siamese twins, but they are identical twins.
Yeah.
So like, oh, maybe he said that they were joined at the hip or something like that, you know? So we start to see, like, glimpses of the reality of the situation, but ultimately, all of these characters did exist, and that's where the son is kind of realizing is that, like, oh, maybe all of his stories weren't quite as bullshit as they seemed, you know? There were details that were off, but not as many details as we were led to believe.
It's like a fisherman's tale.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, and he was trapped behind enemy lines, because earlier we found out that, like, he was thought dead.
Yeah, yeah. And the mother actually confirmed that story. She said, like, oh, yeah, not all of your father's stories are actual fiction, you know?
Yeah, they're not all crazy.
Anyway, we are quite over time, and I think that's a pretty good summary to leave off on. And I think let's move on to the domains. All right, now let's give our representatives a chance to talk about their domains and why they chose them. Keenan, you're up.
That's
tell me about
right.
that movie, which I've already forgotten the name of.
Rashomon. Jeez, you uncultured hack. I should be hosting this episode. This whole podcast should be mine. No. Rashomon is a 1950 period piece by Akira Kurosawa, famous for, of course, Seven Samurai and Throne of Blood. It is about a woodcutter telling the story of this court procession.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit of a murder mystery, but basically, a samurai was killed in the grove, but there are four extremely different stories that we hear.
Okay.
We hear the bandit that claims that he fought him and killed him because he was really attracted to the samurai's wife. And the samurai's wife, like, fell in love with him, and he was like, oh, well, I gotta kill him to, you know, to get her.
Sometimes you just gotta kill someone.
Right? And then the wife's side, which says that actually, yeah, he took advantage of her, and that when he left, she wanted, like, forgiveness from her husband, but, like, he was just looking at her so coldly, and that he just wouldn't stop looking at her, and that she fainted, and then when she came up, her fancy knife, which was, like, this really expensive knife, ended up in his chest, right?
Okay.
And then she tried to kill herself, but it didn't work. But then a medium comes along and says, well, I can tell the story that the samurai will tell.
Okay.
And he says that after, like, they did their thing, the bandit and the wife were like, well, let's get out of here. But the wife was like, nah, you had to kill my husband first because I can't go with either of you unless one of you is dead.
Okay.
So he ended up just killing himself because the bandit was actually like, yo, that's crazy. I won't do that. That's messed up.
So basically, we just get the same story told over and over again from different perspectives, and you're sort of led to question the validity.
Yeah, and then even we get the woodcutter's story,
okay,
who claims that he then saw the whole thing, and it gives a very different story about how they were all, like, wimpy, and, you know, his wife was spoiled, he didn't want to risk his life for the spoiled, and the bandit didn't really want to, like, kill him for it.
Right.
And then he basically died, you know, through a stroke of luck between the two fights, which was a sad fight. And then she just simply ran off.
Is it ever revealed which was the true account, or are we just left to sort of make sense of it?
No, because actually it is kind of talked about, because basically the woodcutter is telling this story to a priest and this random guy that walked up. And the random guy's like, oh, well, I know. All your story's also, like, bullshit. And he's like, what? No, like, that's...
So it's not even the case that they're, like, being investigated or something and are, like, giving their side of the story. It's like they're telling it to people who they don't have, like, a motive to totally lie to.
Yeah, but even then, the commenter's like, oh, I know you're lying. And he's like, what? Why would I lie? It's because you said that the woman's dagger was this really nice pearl inlay. And that sounded really expensive. What happened to the knife, man? Huh? 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 Oh, it's because you stole it. I know this because everyone's just motivated by self-interest.
Okay.
No, yeah, because that's, like, a little bit of the point. Because then the priest is like, oh, I've lost all faith in humanity. Yeah, yeah. And then they find this baby that's been abandoned at this temple.
Oh, shit. Is the baby have the truth? It's like that episode of Black Mirror where it turns out the guinea pig saw the whole thing and they use their memory device to... Never mind.
Yeah. And so...
The fucking guinea pig, man.
Basically, the commoner just takes, like, the kimono and, like, the stuff that the baby was wrapped in and leaves. Meanwhile, the woodcutter says, I'll take that baby because I already have six and I'll be able to provide for him.
All right.
And so it's like a whole new light and renews the priest's faith in humanity. And so this was one of the first movies to really do this sort of, like, unreliable narrator idea, which became known as the Rashomon effect.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But this one is more like an examination of, like, the nature of justice and whatnot, rather than just a simple, unreliable narrator twist, which is what the Rashomon effect refers to. And it's a very superficial relation, but it's still where the origin comes from.
Okay, good shit.
Which is why I picked it, because it has not only one, but four unreliable narrators, which tops all of you.
Yeah, I have definitely been topped.
Yeah, fuck you, you fucking pieces of shit.
Okay, now we're going to be moving on to Kat Manavan. Kat, you've brought fucking Forrest Gump, which was the Academy Award winner of the year I was born. So I like that movie a lot.
That's a weird relation.
It is one of my favorite movies ever of all time. So the reason I chose Forrest Gump, well, I guess... Let me.
Give us a little. Give us a little rundown.
Sure.
For whatever people haven't seen Forrest Gump.
So Forrest Gump is the story of a man.
Oh shit.
Named Forrest Gump.
Oh.
People call him Forrest Gump, and it's basically he's recounting the story of his life while sitting at a bus stop. Now, he isn't exactly the sharpest tool in the shed. But he's a good-natured, good character.
Nice guy.
Pretty much the kind of guy that never heard a fly.
Yeah, he's sort of mentally handicapped, I think, is the...
But, you know, he's basically telling his life story about the kind of stuff he went through while growing up, like being bullied, like being on the football team and being a fast runner.
Sounding familiar?
Being in Vietnam.
Sounding familiar?
Yeah. Shit.
Well...
And falling in love with a girl named Jenny.
Jenny.
What?
It's true. But he was in Korea, so there's a slight difference there.
True. True.
Maybe. But yeah.
He was in Korea. You're right.
Wait, who was in Korea?
Forrest Gump.
No, he was in Vietnam. No,
Forrest Gump was in Vietnam. Bloom was in Korea.
Oh, Edward Bloom was in Korea. Yeah. My bad. Yeah.
But yeah, basically Forrest's story runs parallel to other historical events that some he had a little bit of involvement in, some didn't. And the reason that I chose Forrest Gump as my domain of knowledge was because he basically acts as a narrator from like the 50s to the 80s. And some of it is definitely unreliable.
Right. Like, we sort of see, like, him telling the story of history as he understood it.
Correct.
So not just his life, but also, like, all the events that are happening around him, some of which are, like, you know, real-world events that we all know about, you know?
Mm-hmm. Correct. Like, Watergate. Like,
he goes through Watergate, and yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, Forrest Gump, the reason it's kind of unreliable is because he sort of has these mental handicaps, right? And it goes through and he tells stories basically the way he understood them, but not necessarily mm-hmm. the way they actually happened.
Correct.
So it's not like, as opposed to, you know, both the other cases, he's not really being deceiving. He just doesn't understand the situations quite as everyone else did. He sees it through a different lens.
Yeah, and I think a good example of that is the Watergate scene, where I think he gets the
he's like the one who called it in, right?
Yeah he met President Nixon because he was getting the Medal of Honor, I believe.
You're right.
And then Nixon put him up in the Watergate hotel, and then from his hotel he could see people breaking in, and so he called it in.
And he's like, oh, I think someone's lights are out or something, because I see a bunch of flashlights hanging
yep.
around. And then
yep.
it's like, apparently that was a pretty big deal or something like that. Yeah.
Pretty funny.
Yep.
I don't know if I'd call him unreliable, though, on most part. He's just,
Well, you know what? We'll have a little debate on that, then, in the discussion.
Yeah, we will.
Alrighty. With all of our topics and domains summarized, that's just... who wrote this, Colin? Let's move on to the discussion.
Colin's very verbose.
Verbose.
Well, it's just one sentence, but I just don't like the "with all of our topic and domains summarized," because topic is singular and it's all of our topic sounds weird, even though it's topic and domain. Anyway, we're gonna be moving on to the discussion, and let's talk about different types of unreliable narration and where our certain movies fall into these categories.
I actually wanted to say something about Big Fish.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to say that I liked that in Big Fish, the unreliable narrator was revealed as not actually being that unreliable.
Yeah, he's sort of revealed as...
Which is usually, yeah.
Yeah, usually it goes the other way around. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
We're usually, like, we're led to believe someone's reliable, and then we are presented with information that makes us believe that it might not be accurate. Whereas in Big Fish...
Exactly.
He's still unreliable, but by the end of the movie, we're starting to sort of think that the accounts are closer to the reality than we were led to believe by the son's skepticism.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is an interesting thing about the unreliable narrator in Big Fish. To compare that to something like Forrest Gump, though, I think it's interesting because the way that we're presented the information in Big Fish is we're told the story, and then we're shown the events the way the story is happening. Where, to contrast that with Forrest Gump, he tells his accounts of the story, and then we see the events as they actually happen, so then the, like, dichotomy between what he's telling us and what's actually happening are sort of like a humorous thing, you know?
Yeah.
Like, for example, with Watergate, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or the fruit company.
Right, he thought something... Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, he says that he gets a lot of money because he invested in a fruit company, and we see in the... movie, he pulls out a letter with the Apple logo on it, and it's like, oh, haha, he thought it was a fruit company because it's Apple.
Yeah.
And we know why he got a lot of money out of investing in Apple.
Right.
Yeah.
And Keenan, I'll give you a chance to talk about why you don't think he's an unreliable narrator. So, go ahead.
Yeah, talk shit all you want.
Yeah, I was just gonna say that. I think it is... I don't feel comfortable saying that he is an unreliable narrator, because an unreliable narrator seems to imply a certain willingness to be unreliable, I have found. Like,
I don't know.
For example, that in Rashomon, like, they...
Which,
all...
That's not present at all in Big Fish, though.
Well, no, because he is telling tall tales, you know?
But what I was going to say was that, like, in Rashomon, they're all telling these stories out of self-interest to make themselves look better, or to explain away something, or to hide stuff. Meanwhile, in...
Big Fish?
No, in Forrest Gump, he's not telling things because he's necessarily wrong about stuff. He's just because he mm-hmm. just doesn't know. He tells things as far as he knows.
Yeah.
I think it'd be like saying that Scout from To Kill a Mockingbird.
Well, I mean,
would be an unreliable narrator, but it's not because, it's just because they're like, because of the situation of the character, they're not necessarily lying, they're just simply not even like omitting anything, they're just simply misunderstanding what's happening.
Yeah, no, I mean, I have an answer to that, but I'll let Matt jump in first.
Yeah,
Matt, try.
The thing is, Forrest himself is a narrator. Remember, he's sitting on the park bench telling his,
well, yes, he's a narrator.
Basically his life story to the lady. But, you know, they're not there, I guess, watching the film, you know?
Yeah.
If you were to listen to Forrest's narration without the historical backdrop behind it, you'd be led to believe that, you know, there's like this great apple company, like the food apples,
right,
that he invested in, and then he was, you know, set for life.
Right. Or you might led to believe that it was just an innocent thing happening with Watergate and that there wasn't anything fishy there.
Right, yeah. Oh, yeah. He stopped like a robbery at a hotel. And because of that historical backdrop, it almost validates it, you know?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I get you. However, I would say, though, that I don't think anything that Forrest says is untrue. It's simply his interpretation of some things are untrue. Like,
just like in Big Fish, though.
Because he did say he had money in an apple company, and it was Apple.
But he said a fruit company, though, specifically.
Yeah, he said a fruit company.
Well, in the book, he said Apple.
Okay.
We're talking about the movie. I don't know. I haven't...
Yeah, well, in the book, I mean, like I said, it was still like a fruit company. It's just not exactly like in fruit.
It's apples and oranges.
You're a terrible person.
I'm sorry.
Or like when he said that something jumped up and bit him. He did get hurt. He was shot. It wasn't an animal that jumped up and bit him, but he like was injured.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those things that, like I said, his like the base facts of his story.
Yeah.
Except for like one or two instances, all check out. It's simply his interpretation, which I don't think is necessarily makes him like a very unreliable narrator. I mean, he's not like I said, he's not like Kaiser Sosuke or like the people in Rashomon, which are like blatantly lying and like they're very clearly, you know, giving an unreliable story. But because of that does make him kind of reliable about these things.
Yeah, no, but like, okay, so the thing I would have to say to this, honestly, is that like I agree that Forrest Gump is not an unreliable narrator to the same extent as the characters in Rashomon or in Big Fish, but I think that he is an unreliable narrator. The definition of unreliable narrator doesn't seem to imply that it has to be intentional, because, like, we know that his worldview is slightly skewed by the fact that he has a different understanding of things than other people, and he just doesn't know some things. Like, I agree that it's like, oh, it's not him telling that lie, it's that he just misunderstands some things, but he is telling the misunderstanding.
See, for me, unreliable narrator is mostly just, you know, personal bias, where people put their perspectives or their wants and needs before telling 100% the truth, you know?
Mm.
Forrest Gump, obviously, he tells things the way he sees it. He's not is he not like a friggin' documentary? Keenan, your domain, I wish I could pronounce it.
Rashomon.
You've got four characters basically trying to, the way you described it is like basically save themselves, try to tell the stories so that it like benefited them in the long run.
Yeah.
They each had their reasons behind altering the truth. But, you know, bias is what makes an unreliable narrator, I think.
Yeah, I mean...
All right, well, that's true then. I don't see any bias that Forrest Gump has.
Yeah, I don't think bias is necessary. I think that you can either be biased and purposely unreliable, or you can be, you know, like, not have all the information quite there, you know? Because there are narrators that, like, give information that they wouldn't have and say stuff like, oh, I found this out later and stuff like that, you know? I think, like, really it's sort of a spectrum, and Forrest Gump falls in kind of a gray area.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, you're right, he's not lying, and for the most part, his facts do play out. They're just, like, simplified versions of it.
I want to say that one of the things that I think, because you have to also think that, how do you identify when a narrator is being unreliable? And I think that has a certain level... At least, not necessarily in film. In a film, it's a lot trickier to, like, obscure it most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, most of the time when it's an unreliable narrator, you have to think about, like, who is benefiting from this version of events, you know?
Yeah.
To whose self-interest does this story most play to? And I think that's, like, when, in other, like, stuff, when you find out, oh, it was a lie because this guy was setting up this for this to happen, XYZ, ABC, and you're like, oh my god, he was an unreliable guy the whole time, you know? But that's like the Rashomon effect. I think all three of these actually very much do what Rashomon was initially intended, which is to examine, like, what is truth?
Right, yeah.
It's whatever you make of it.
And I think that Big Fish falls in an interesting part there because we learned that most of the events happened, like, more or less how he told them, but he told them in a fantastical sort of way. We know that some version of those events happen, but we don't know the actual event that happens. And I think that the message that the movie kind of tries to leave us on is that it doesn't matter, is that, like, the truth matters to an extent, but ultimately, like, the son ends up accepting that, like, the versions of the story that his dad told them might as well be just as good as the truth, because those were what he got out of it, you know? Like, what Edward Bloom got out of the events of his life, instead of, like, the actual, like, specific factual details.
Exactly.
Okay, I wanna turn us towards... We're gonna do a little comparison.
All right.
Because I think that we picked some interesting examples here to compare. You know, I'll start with Keenan, because we've been talking about Forrest Gump for a little while.
All right.
One thing I want to ask, so in Big Fish, we're led right away to believe that Albert Finney / Ewan McGregor is kind of unreliable, right?
They're tall tales.
Yeah, they're tall tales.
Tall tales.
My point is, we're told right off the bat that we have reason to doubt the information we're being given.
Right. Yes. Okay.
In Rashomon, when do we learn that? Like, do we get the first story, and then we learn that it might be unreliable by being told the second story, and then we know everything from there is unreliable? Or, like, when are we presented with any reason to believe that any of the people telling us these stories might be lying?
Yeah, well, the movie starts off with, like I said, a commoner walking in on this temple while it's raining, and there's this priest there, and then there's also this woodcutter, and the woodcutter's just babbling to himself that it doesn't make any sense. And he keeps going over and over, and the commoner's like, well, I'd like to hear a good story. So, like, what doesn't make sense? He's like, well, you know, it's, like, just what happened. At first, I say that the impression is the event doesn't make any sense, right?
Right.
Like, why is this guy dead kind of a thing? So you get the first story, and you're like, oh, my God. And then he's like, yeah, but, like, then the woman came up, and it's like, oh, she gave a story? It's like, yeah, she showed up, like, later that day and gave this story. Like, oh, and they're like, but it gets even weirder because we get this third story. So I think it's right about, we get a hint at the beginning that it's weird.
Right.
But then you get the first story, and then you're like, all right, well, what exactly is weird about that? Then you get, well, according to this, though, then gotcha. Once you hear the woman's story, that's when you start to fear it's unreliable.
So it's really the second story that...
Yeah, but after the third one, it gets so different because there are still core pieces of the story that are repeated over and over.
Right.
You know, like, the bandit did take advantage of the woman. She did ask him to kill her husband, and a fight did then ensue, somehow.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that, like, these three, like, major points did happen. Eventually, the guy ended up dead one way or another.
Okay, so basically what I'm getting at here, right, is that there probably are better examples of stories where, you know, you don't learn till rather late in the narrative that the narrator might be unreliable. But this is kind of the closest we got. How do you think the effect differs from that as compared to Big Fish, where we're, like, intentionally led to believe right off the bat that we shouldn't be believing everything that we hear? Like, what different effect do you think that has?
Well, I would say that Rashomon was more of a, I don't want to say intellectual, but it was more of a philosophical question about truth and justice and where exactly one becomes real.
Right.
Meanwhile, I still think that actually Big Fish achieved the same effect that a story where you make a twist of it being an unreliable narrator.
Yeah.
Just as well. Because, like, for example, in, say, The Usual Suspects, where you don't find out the narrator is really lying until the very, very end. Well, it kind of goes into the same vein as finding out that the narrator was telling the truth for the most part until the very, very end.
Hmm.
Because that's still, like, the twist, because you're still surprised and you're still taken aback.
Yeah.
Because you believed that this one set of events that you were told about, you believed it a certain way. And then the revelation about the narrator's reliability, whether or not it became more reliable or less reliable, is still there, the impact still happens.
Yeah, right. That's interesting. So I feel like it sort of has the opposite effect, whereas, like, you know, when you get the twist that the narrator is, like, less reliable than you think of, then you start to sort of, like, think of that person within that lens and think of them as lesser, right? Or not, like, lesser, but, like, you know, worse in some sense, right? Whereas, like, what it does in Big Fish is where it brings it back and sort of restores our faith in Edward Bloom as a character, because we're immediately told to be skeptical of him no matter how charming he seems as Ewan McGregor. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So charming.
So very charming.
Ewan McGregor is so, so charming. He seems so charming.
That's interesting, right? Because, like, so in Forrest Gump, right, I don't think we're ever, like, immediately told that we shouldn't be believing him, but we just kind of, like, get it throughout the things that he says and how we know those to not, like, perfectly line up with the reality of the situation. Matt, do you want to talk about, like, the effect that it has on the film? Because I feel like it's sort of used as a sort of comedic element to the movie.
You mean, like, the fact, like, Forrest's perspective?
How does that make us view Forrest?
Yeah, like, how does it make us view him? Like, I don't think... I would say I don't think it makes me see him as any better or any worse, but, like, I don't know. Like, do you think that...
I think there's times when it definitely provides comedic element.
Yeah.
Comedic element, Jesus Christ. It's times when it's funny. Jesus Christ. I think that he basically goes on throughout the movie pretty much doing whatever he wants, you know, whatever he believes right. is the best thing.
Whatever Forrest wants, he gets.
For him in the moment. You know, he's almost like the feather that's, like, throughout the whole damn movie where he just kind of floats yeah. along through life. And he's there and he's just observing brief moments. But he doesn't really have an ulterior motive.
Right.
He's just, you know, floating through, doing what he does.
Do you think that the fact that he's an unreliable narrator changes our view of him? Because if you ask me, and I'll just, like, interject for a quick second, it makes him more endearing, if anything.
Yeah.
No, I think so.
Because, like, it represents a sort of innocence where he doesn't see things the way the rest of the world sees them. And in some cases, I think we're sort of, like, pushed towards thinking that maybe the way that he sees them is a bit more pure than the rest of the world, ourself included, sees them. Would you say mm-hmm. that's the case?
No, I would agree with that.
So, yeah, no, I think Kenan's right. I think it does make him a little bit more endearing because it's just like, you know, he assumes the best in people, whereas, like, we see events and we're like, oh, that guy's being an asshole, and Forrest Gump, you know, is just, like, nice to him, and then sometimes that gets him some places, and sometimes it gets him taken advantage of, and
mm-hmm.
I don't know. I want to steer this towards, compare that a little bit to Edward Bloom, where I don't know that we could necessarily say that Edward Bloom has much of an ulterior motive either, but I don't know. Why don't you talk about that a little bit, Matt?
So I think that, you know, Edward Bloom, he describes himself as a natural storyteller. And, right. you know, a lot of people who tell stories, they have a tendency to exaggerate,
mm-hmm.
especially fishermen. Cough, cough, nudge, nudge.
Ha!
So I think comparing him and Forrest, I guess the question becomes, is Forrest a natural storyteller? Because it doesn't feel like he doesn't really have purpose, per se.
Right, like, Forrest is not trying to be a storyteller. He just might, like, Edward Bloom, I guess, if you said he had an ulterior motive, it would be he wants to tell these stories in a way that are more narratively interesting than perhaps they actually happened, right?
Right, and, you know, be there for his family and stuff.
Yeah.
Which I think is like, the penultimate motive behind everything.
So I think, like, you know, in some ways it's like, oh, him trying to connect with his son and trying to, you know, give him the lessons that he's learned throughout life. But it, in some ways, like, the son sees it as him being, like, egotistical and just, like, talking on and on about his own life.
Mm-hmm.
Right. All right. So I don't think that we got any listener questions this week because Colin never made a post about this movie. I'm not salty at all. He definitely just mentioned it in the episode before and the episode after's post. Not that we got any questions for those either, so I'm mostly...
You look a little green with envy.
I'm being salty on principle, not in practicality.
I'm salty on principle.
But do we have any closing thoughts about the concept of unreliable narration in general, because I think that we've brought three very different examples on how it's utilized. Like, the Rashomon effect specifically is about, like, hearing the same story told over again by different people, whereas, like, in both of our other stories, we have just one person telling the tale, right? One person who's embellishing facts and one person who doesn't understand the whole truth himself. I actually think that the purpose of all three of these movies and their unreliable narration is very different, and I sort of want to hear from you guys, like, what you think each of these films was trying to do with its unreliable narration, and then I'll pipe in a little bit at the end.
I was just going to say that I personally really like the unreliable narrator, especially when it's used and we find out that they're unreliable, because it's really interesting to go back through the movie or literature to find out at what point could you have picked up on it if you were looking for it, kind of thing. I think that's a very interesting, because it's something that can be done very poorly, but if it's done right, it's beautiful. As for our movies ourselves, I think that Forrest Gump was used as a comedic slash characterizing effect. One, because it's kind of funny to look back on it, and then also to, once again, as Matt discussed earlier, that is to kind of like make him more endearing and kind of like more interesting because of how naive and innocent he is. Meanwhile, in Big Fish, it's kind of like the idea of verisimilitude, where he kind of becomes larger than life, but at the same time, you get what he meant.
Nice big words there.
Yeah, with each of those stories, you still got like what he meant by each of those stories and what the stories meant to him and how he affected people. But maybe the facts weren't exactly right, and kind of about, you know, the son dealing with that kind of father and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I, you know, Keenan pretty much knocked it out of the park there. I think Forrest Gump, his role is basically just to be endearing and partially like comedic purpose, but definitely meant to be more engaging for the audience. Imagine watching a movie, like a documentary, and narrated by Forrest Gump, you know? That's basically what it is.
Right, yeah. Forrest Gump is interesting because it goes over a lot of history that, you know, we know the real events of.
Yeah, I think it'd be interesting if, you know, life in general... Now I have this weird this idea, freaking Arrested Development narrated by Forrest Gump.
Oh my god,
crazy.
But yeah, no, I mean, I generally agree with Keenan. I think that in Forrest Gump it was used as a form of characterization for Forrest. I think in Rashomon it very much seems like the intent of it is to make you question like truth as a concept and like how much can you really know the real truth of the situation.
Right.
In Big Fish, it sort of seems like the message is sometimes the facts of a story don't matter as much, or they matter the same as what you get out of the story and the lessons you learn from it.
Seeing isn't believing. Believing is seeing.
Yeah, word. Good line there. But with that, I think we're gonna leave off and go towards the ratings. All right, now we are moving on to the ratings section. Thank you both for a very enlightening discussion. It says adjective in our little script here, so I just picked a random word, and enlightening is the where the dart stuck, apparently. Now we're going to be moving on to the ratings, and we're going to begin by having each of our representatives rate the topic on a scale of 1 to 5, geez, I don't know, something out of this movie. There's lots of great stuff.
What was her favorite flower?
I don't remember.
Daffodils.
Daffodils.
All right, you know what? We're going to go on a scale from, what if that's just wrong? I got to look that up before I say that.
No, they're daffodils. I watched it last night.
Okay, fine.
Screw you.
We're going to go on a scale from 1 to 5 daffodils, which were the wife's favorite flower. We didn't talk about that at all. Whatever. You know what? 1 to 5 daffodils. All right, hit me up, Keenan. What did you think about this movie?
I would give it, because of its endearing characters, its fantastic acting, as well as art direction, oddly enough. Because for such a kind of like bright and fantastical movie... And I focus on bright and very, like, positive. You wouldn't think that Tim Burton would be very good at it. But he did. And it, like, really brought some life.
Oh, I love
and
Tim
it was.
Burton.
Yeah, no, I love Tim Burton too. But, like, my point is this had, like, yellow like colors in it, and like that's like way out of his element, let alone red or blue. Just kidding, blue's in it, but it's also a very muted blue. Yeah, I would actually give it probably 4. It's not perfect, but it's pretty close. It's pretty close. 4 daffodils.
4 daffodils out of 5. All right, go ahead.
I think I would give it 4 daffodils. I'd also like to submit an appeal to change the award name to, instead of the golden daffodil, the golden holy car bomb bomb.
Helen Barb bomb bomb bomb. Helen Barbara bomb. Well, that's not going to be we're not going to do the golden daffodil, but I already know what the gold star is going to be. But, you know, your appeal is taken into consideration for the golden hell bomb bomb com cup bomb. The name that I couldn't say. I'm glad that one of us started that joke, because I'm horrible at saying her name the way that it's supposed to be said.
But yeah, I would give it 4 out of 5, just because I grew Kenan's very endearing story. It was cute. It was nice.
Yeah.
There seemed like there's a lot of unnecessary angstiness.
Oh my god, yes.
From the sun sometimes.
From the sun. Yeah, I mean, I get his perspective.
You know,
though.
That boy was like a fucking salt factory.
Practically Lot's wife.
Like, oh my god. Enough to warrant losing 1 holy car bomb bomb.
Oh, that's rough.
So.
That's fair. Yeah, Will was a little bit salty, but that drove the story forward. Yeah. Well, I'm happy you guys liked it. This is actually, I think, probably my favorite movie. But yeah. Next, I'm going to be moving on to award the Gold Star student, giving the reward to the person who I think just contributed best to the conversation in this episode. And today, I will be giving out the Golden Big Fish. Not the movie, but a big fish. You know, like the big carp in the movie.
Yeah, we got it.
It was a catfish, not a carp.
Yeah, it's a catfish, you moron.
Whatever. Catfish and carp are like the same fucking thing, aren't they?
No.
No. No, they're very different.
A catfish is a terrifying monster.
You're
okay?
Right, it is a catfish. Okay, so the golden big catfish. And today I think that the golden fish, big fish, is going to have to go to Mr. Kenan Kodish.
Nice.
You did both make some pretty good comments. I fucking, every single time I'm like, I should write these down so I know what I'm talking about when I get to the rating section, but I never do.
How about you just remember them?
You both had some pretty good comments in there, but I think Kenan said some really good things talking about the point of how the unreliable narration was used in the films. I definitely had a specific comment in mind, but I can't remember it. So you know what? I'm gonna just edit it right here, because I'm the one editing this episode, and I know that you two are the only ones who have conceded that I'm pointing, and pointing doesn't make any sense since we're talking about audio, but right here, that's where it's going.
I still think that actually, Big Fish achieved the same effect that a story where you make a twist of it being an unreliable narrator, because that's still like the twist, because you're still surprised and you're still taken aback, because you believed that this one set of events that you were told about, you believed it a certain way. And then the revelation about the narrator's reliability is still there. The impact still happens. Thank you, Jeff, for that very exact example of our friend, of what I was saying. No, thank you. I am glad to have received a golden catfish.
But not to be confused with like catfishing as a concept. I don't want to catfish you, Kenan.
And the golden catfisher of the year goes to.
Since it is a catfish, I'm kind of sad I'm not giving it to Cat Manavan, but that's all right.
That's all right. I don't want to be the golden catfisher.
But Kenan also does have a mustache, which catfish have, so that is also thematically, you know, relevant.
Sure.
Way to ride the mustache. Damn.
All right, thanks, guys. That was a fun episode. This is about wrapping it up. Thank you all for listening to the Comic Geeking program. I am your host, Jeff. And again, we were talking about Big Fish today, directed by Tim Burton, 2003 movie. And you can find me. I have an Instagram. It is Things I Wish Existed with a dot between each word. I post some art stuff on there. I also have a YouTube channel that's just Jeff Levitt. I only have like 5 videos on there, though. A couple of them are like artsy bullshit.
We should shamelessly plug the Coalition of Heroes.
Yeah, I mean, there's nowhere to find the Coalition of Heroes.
You can find it on YouTube.
Oh, it is on YouTube. You're right. We do have, is that Coalition of Heroes. Is that what the YouTube channel is called too?
We should figure it out for another time.
No, I'm gonna look it up right now. We'll talk about the fucking, you know what? What, you know, I'll save that. Matt, you look it up and I'll let you pimp that out. All right. And yeah, so you can find me on Instagram. I do have a YouTube channel. It's just called Jeff Levitt. I only have like 5 videos on there. One of them is about juggling and I just posted it. That was fun. And again, this week I have been joined by Keenan and Matt. And do you guys have anywhere you would like to pimp yourselves out on, Keenan?
You know what? You may find me everywhere because that is where I am. Just think of, you know, something great. Just so you know, that is I.
Literally everywhere. He's in your toilet right now.
Whenever you bite into a delicious, freshly cooked brownie, that joy you feel is me. And whenever you eat, I don't know what you're allergic, if you're allergic to chocolate, whenever you just, I don't know, like high five your best friend, that's me flowing through you.
I would love some Keenan special brownies.
Yeah, you would.
You're saying that every time someone has an allergic reaction, that is also you?
Same.
I mean, I don't really want to get into my doctor and my theology right now.
Every time Matt eats a peanut, Keenan is the reason he needs an EpiPen.
Now, like I said, that's why to people who are allergic, the metaphor is different. Of a high five between friends, a good friend that you haven't seen in a while, that like firm, good high five, like you looked at each other's elbows while you were doing it, bam.
You're saying an allergic reaction is someone giving you a high five?
I literally said that's kind of fucked up. The metaphor changed.
A high five to your insides.
Yeah, in a way, it's kind of true, you know?
High five to your insides.
It's not true at all.
I am the only medical professional here, okay?
I'm the one with the allergy.
Oh, well, just because you have it doesn't mean you know anything about it. What's the technical term?
Jesus Christ. Anyway, Matt, you exist.
Stop recording. Stop recording now.
Anaphylactic, bitch.
Matt, who are you? Can you be found? Are you interested in pimping out the Coalition of Heroes YouTube channel?
Oh, if people want to find me, then...
they can find me in hell.
They'll figure it out.
Did you find the YouTube channel?
It's Coalition of Heroes at YouTube. I can't believe we're actually doing this.
You brought it up, all right? Your Coalition of Heroes is an awful movie we made while we were in high school. We started trying to make a second one and it never happened. Maybe we'll talk about that sometime again. We should have an episode on Coalition of Heroes sometime.
Wait.
But not actually.
You just took one of my ideas.
You can do it. I don't give a shit. Anyway, next week our episode will actually be hosted by Matt. Is that correct?
That is correct.
He's a little bit of a fucking blast from the past.
Our theme is going to be sequels, and I will be discussing Coalition of Heroes.
No, you fucking won't. Shut up. What are you going to be talking about next week, Matt?
Oh, I'm watching Shrek 2.
Oh, Jesus. See, fucking, I kind of wish I was on that episode, because I actually really fucking don't like Shrek 2 or any of the sequels to Shrek.
Yo, Shrek 2 is so good, though.
Yeah, Shrek 2 is almost better than the first.
I know. It's a controversial opinion. I also do not like Shrek 2. I only like the first Shrek. But the unspoken rule of the Common Geeking program is every time there's someone who's on the podcast who does not like the thing that you're talking about, that person will inevitably win the gold star. So I wish I were on that episode.
Yep.
Hey, I liked Big Fish.
Yeah, I'm not referring to this episode. People win other times as well. I'm just saying, every time someone doesn't like something, they end up winning the gold star. Like, Colin won the Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood episode.
That was bougie.
Didn't Laura win the episode on wizards?
No, Laura just brought up good points.
Keenan won the Arrested Development episode.
I don't know about that one.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm not saying it's for that reason. I'm saying that it always happens. It's a, you know, it's a trope.
You know what, Jeff? Next episode we're on, I'll find something you know absolutely nothing about, okay? Then you can win.
That doesn't mean I won't like it.
So, I'll make sure.
Anyway, Matt's episode is going to be airing next week on the 13th of July.
It's going to be lit sauce.
Be sure to tune in on... Oh, I already said that.
You literally just said that.
And so make sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Geeking Program. Any engagement, such as sharing, tagging us, tweeting hashtag CGP, will enter you into a raffle where you get to pick the topic for a future episode.
And you get $100 from Colin Ketchin.
Yeah, yes, you get... You know what? We get $200 from Colin Ketchin. I'll up the stakes, you know, on his behalf.
Colin Ketchin will drive to your house and personally have dinner with you.
And remember, guys, reviewing us on Apple Podcasts is actually really helpful to helping our show grow. And we will read new reviews on the air. Do we fucking have any? We don't have any. I'm not even going to check. I mean, I just checked. We don't have any. You can't prove otherwise because you don't know when this was recorded.
Yeah.
Anyway, guys, thank you all for listening, subscribing, sharing, everything, what the fuck ever you did. Just thanks. And we'll talk to you next week.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Doodly doo.
This episode of the Common Geeking Program was hosted by me, Jeff Levitt, joined by the representatives, Keenan Kodish and Matt Canavan. This episode is sponsored by Hella Bonbon Cart... I can't even say that right. The podcast is created and produced by Colin Ketchin and Jeff Levitt, with this episode edited by me, Jeff, and featuring original music by Colin Ketchin. Next week, we'll be talking about Shrek 2 and successful sequels, so be sure to tune in for that on July 13th. And as always, thank you for listening to this.
Pretty good summary to leave off on, and I think let's move on to the domains.
All right, so I once again am Keenan.
Hold on.
What?
Hold on. I've got a fucking read for this. All right, now let's give our representatives a chance to talk about their domains.